In just about every American war, there's a call to bring our boys back home safe. Well, the phrase does not really apply anymore. We want them home safely, all right, but it's much broader than just boys. Women make up an ever larger portion of our fighting forces. Their contributions and sacrifices in Iraq and Afghanistan far outstrip the activities of women in any previous war. Helen Thorpe is a journalist who spent several years in the company of military women. The result is her book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. As I mentioned, Helen Thorpe is a journalist working in several media. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker and Harper's Bazaar and Slate, among others. She also produced radio stories for This American Life and Soundprint. Her previous book is Just Like Us, about Mexican girls growing up in America. Helen Thorpe, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
The explosion in numbers of women in the service, I mean, how big a boost are we talking about here since, say, 2000?
It's been dramatic in terms of the numbers of women who've gone overseas during these conflicts compared with the past. Over the period of time that you're talking about, the numbers of women serving in the military inched upwards from around 12% to 15%. But because the two conflicts, Iraq and Afghanistan, deployed more women as soldiers, as Marines, as airmen and as sailors than ever before, it's just been dramatically different in terms of women living overseas on military posts.
And what are the rules? You make some reference to this in the book about the P1 to P7 scale, the probability of their ending up in combat. And so I'm not easily tracking with the changes that have taken place lately. Are women allowed in P1 situations now, or has it not quite gotten there yet?
You know, everything's in transition as we speak, because Leon Panetta announced that women were going to be allowed in many previously banned positions. There are still positions that are off limits, but women are transitioning into many positions that were previously ruled off limits. So just to step back a little bit, women have served in all kinds of ways throughout our history, primarily as nurses. So they've often gone to war, but typically in the past it was in the role of nurse. These conflicts have been really different because women have actually served, say, in the Army as soldiers, right alongside their male colleagues, often doing the same work. But as you mentioned, because the military wasn't sure how it felt about women serving and the public wasn't sure either, for a long time we were operating under a system where the military has been rating different types of work according to a probability scale in terms of the likelihood of experiencing extreme danger or bodily injury. And they were trying to prevent women from having to bear the brunt of conflict, as men have always done. So you saw women often over the last decade serving in what are called support positions. And the women I wrote about were serving in support positions. And the kind of work they did ranged from fixing broken weapons to tracking the maintenance being done on vehicles, or towards the end of the book, in their second deployment, one of the women does convoy security, where she's trying to ensure that food or fuel or ammunition will make it to military bases throughout the Iraq war theater by driving a gun truck at the front of a convoy, trying to ensure it will get where it's going.
Which is pretty close to combat anyway. I mean, if you're driving a gun truck, sure, defending a convoy, basically.
Right. And she had originally trained to do logistics, which is, in her case, was tracking maintenance on vehicles. And she did that work during the Afghanistan deployment. But the nature of her work changed a lot during the second deployment when she was asked instead to do convoy security. Not what she had trained to do when she originally chose her job specialty, but that's what the Army needed at that point in time. And that was not atypical. A lot of people had to sort of do work that wasn't exactly their job specialty throughout these two conflicts.
Simply because the need was there?
Because the need was there. Because of the length of the conflicts, as they dragged on and on, it was difficult to recruit, and you saw people redeploy often in different capacities.
Helen, was there an incident or a sequence of events that cemented your resolve to write this book?
You know, I felt over the last decade that it was just really hard for me as a civilian staying at home to follow these conflicts and understand them in a personal way. I would read the headlines and I would try and understand, was the war going well in Afghanistan or how was it going in Iraq? But I didn't feel I couldn't get a personal connection that I wanted to have with the people who were serving. I couldn't understand what their lives were like. It was hard to get a sense of what they were doing. And so I started interviewing veterans in 2010. I quickly met Michelle Fisher, and then she introduced me to Desma Brooks and Debbie Helton, her two very close friends. And those three women became the central characters in the book.
All right, we'll talk more about them and about their names, too, because there is some a little changing going on here just to make sure that they're protected. The book is called Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. You just heard their names, Michelle Fisher, Debbie Helton, and Desma Brooks, as related in the book. We'll come back and talk more to Helen Thorpe, who wrote that book, and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with Helen Thorpe and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Helen Thorpe, a journalist and the author of the book Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War, in which she tracks the progress of three women involved in both Iraq, and Afghanistan, wars in which there was a great American military presence for women, larger than in previous efforts. Join us on the Exchange if you'd like to talk about the subject matter. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So just from the fact that you had to change the name of one woman, I'm thinking they were probably easy to talk to, but somewhat hard to get them to talk on the record.
So when we first began the project, the women asked if it would be okay if they used pseudonyms. And I said, absolutely. If that's what it took to make them feel comfortable so that they could share their full story, that was not a problem for me. The women said, okay, great, and we'll decide at the end after we talk to you for a while. So we did 4 years of interviews, and they shared all kinds of things, from letters home, diaries they had kept. One woman shared her entire medical file and therapy notes because she came home from the second deployment battling post-traumatic stress disorder and a head injury. So just a wealth of very personal, intimate material. At the end of all of that, two of the women felt very strongly they really wanted to use their real names. And one woman felt really strongly that she really wanted to use a pseudonym. And I hadn't anticipated that. I thought they would all agree one way or the other. But in the end, I just wanted to honor what they felt was right for them. The woman who chose a pseudonym is the youngest, and she's starting a new career. She's in graduate school right now, and she anticipates going on the job market in a little while. And she was envisioning, you know, future employers sort of being able to Google her and learn all this personal stuff. It made her uncomfortable. Whereas the other two women are a little bit older and more established in their chosen professions, and they weren't sort of facing that particular issue. Then I tried to give the choice of using a pseudonym or not to everybody else in the book, since the women, you know, essentially split on that question. And I thought, well, if they got the choice and they've chosen differently, I better let everybody have the choice. So I reached out to as many people mentioned in the book as possible. And when I couldn't reach them, I generally chose to use a pseudonym for them because it didn't seem fair to put their real names in the book if they had never spoken with me. And
Particularly ex-boyfriends and people.
Exactly.
That, yes. Right.
Exactly.
Because, yeah, they don't always come out sounding particularly great in the parts of the book in which your guests, your friends are talking about them. How did you connect with these women in the first place, Helen?
So Michelle Fisher was living in Denver, Colorado at the time when I started my research, and I live in Denver. So I met her through a mutual friend who knew that I was interviewing different veterans, and I was just struck by her incredible memory for detail, the fact that she had written lots of letters, that she was a great writer. When she told me about her two close friends, Desma and Debbie, and I began to understand the fact that the three women represented three different generations. So you had Michelle, a young college student with no children who had signed up for tuition. And then you had Desma, a single mother with three children, who signed up partly because she had dropped out of high school and it gave her a sense of pride to enlist and to be competent in the military, but also for an extra paycheck. And then Debbie, who's 30 years older than Michelle, so Debbie's the oldest of the three, and she's a beautician, and she loves that work, but serving in the military, she thought, gave her a much greater sense of accomplishment. And she became a grandmother during their first deployment to Afghanistan. So three different stages of life, and they also happen to have equally a great range in terms of their political beliefs. Michelle voted for Ralph Nader. Desma voted for George Bush. Debbie doesn't vote. She doesn't like politicians. Equally different responses to the two wars. You know, you had Michelle opposing both of them, Desma supporting the war in Afghanistan, skeptical about the war in Iraq, and Debbie sort of following the lead of military commanders in supporting both wars.
I'm curious then, because, you know, given that they come in with different political views and for that reason perhaps somewhat stronger or less strong views of what's going on around them, I mean, was it easier, for example, for Debbie to just follow orders?
Much easier, I think. I mean, the way that Debbie describes, say, basic training is totally different than the way Michelle describes the same experience. Debbie says, look, my dad was a drill sergeant in the Army. He told me you can make this hard on yourself or you can make it easier on yourself. She decided to make it easier on herself. She just followed every order she was given during basic training, tried to get along as well as possible with drill sergeants who were often yelling at her. She tried never to take offense. Even though she had enlisted a little bit later in life, she was 34 when she signed up. The cutoff age was 35. So she's one of the oldest people in basic training when she goes. And the drill sergeants are yelling things at her like, come on, Granny, keep up with the young recruits. Come on, Granny Hilton. And she just decided to never get ruffled, you know, to make it as smooth a process as she could by just going with the flow. And then you have Michelle, who is left-leaning, liberal, likes smoking pot, doesn't feel in tune with other people in the military necessarily who have different sorts of beliefs than she does. And the drill sergeants are just driving her nuts. She thinks basic training is like a form of indoctrination. You know, she's rebelling at every turn.
Well, it's curious, too, because at least in two of these cases, it was a pretty narrow window for them to get in. And in Debbie's case, if she'd been a little older, she wouldn't have been eligible.
Right.
I think it was Desma who was just a few pounds from not being eligible by weight.
So the three women all signed up before 9/11, and they signed up for the National Guard, really envisioning a part-time commitment. So they didn't foresee 9/11 happening, of course. And they didn't envision overseas deployments. They enlisted at sort of very different time frames. When Debbie enlisted, it was the 80s, and she was one of the first women allowed into the National Guard unit in which they all eventually came to serve. Then you see Desma enlist in the 90s, when there are quite a number of women already in the unit. But by the time Michelle enlists in the spring of 2001, a number of young women like herself have chosen to join for college tuition benefits. She represents kind of the hallmark young female person who signs up. It's one of the main reasons that women are, you know, joining the military in larger numbers are those tuition benefits.
And in Michelle's case in particular, she's a bright student, certainly was a bright student through high school, so yeah. showed a lot of promise. I'm a little surprised she couldn't find scholarships or grants or something else that might have helped her pay for college other than the National Guard.
That's right. She probably would have been eligible if she knew how to look for those things. She came from a rocky background. Her parents, who were married to each other two times, had separated finally for the last time when she was quite young.
Yeah, what was the number on her dad? Married six times to four women?
He was. Married six times to four women. And he also when she was very young and before she was born, he had been in and out of jail a little bit. He was working the whole time she was growing up primarily as a truck driver, and her mother was working primarily in different factories in southern Indiana. But because her parents were living apart and had divorced, her mom, when she was doing factory work, was trying to support a child essentially on her own. Her dad was not providing them with much assistance. And so her mom was battling poverty all the time, just staying one step ahead of it, sometimes losing a job and temporarily being on welfare and then getting back on her feet again. Neither of her parents had been to college, and they didn't know how to help her find those scholarships, and she didn't find them on her own. She first started going to commuter college, and then she realized it wasn't challenging, and she really aspired to more, and that's when she remembered a military recruiter having come to her high school and speaking about the free tuition if you enlisted. So she did join the National Guard and was hoping that it would allow her to go to Indiana University.
We're talking to Helen Thorpe, the journalist, about her book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War, a discussion of three women of different generations who all served in Iraq and Afghanistan with their National Guard unit. Didn't sign up for the National Guard thinking they were going to end up in overseas wars, but that's certainly what they got multiple times. Join us on The Exchange as we talk about women in the military and perhaps the military more generally. 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. It's interesting that that number, or at least the discussion of the tuition, seems to be what really lights up the eyes of a lot of young people. I've got one son who just turned 18, one who turned 18 a year ago, and they both got calls from recruiters saying, mm-hmm. We'll pay for your college.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating because we all have heard of the GI Bill, probably, and we think of it largely in connection with World War II, and we think of it as something that allowed returning veterans coming back from war a chance to start a new life. And that was its original incarnation. But the later versions of the GI Bill were actually offering tuition benefits to people as an enticement to enlist in the first place, really different than its original incarnation. So it's become one of the primary recruiting tools that the military has to get young people to enlist.
Which certainly was got Michelle Fisher in. As you pointed out in the book, she signed her National Guard contract in March of 2001. By March of 2002, do you think she would have made that move?
She certainly wouldn't have. I'm quite sure of that. She was in she had just finished basic training, and she was in what's known as advanced individual training, getting her job specialty skills as a weapons mechanic at Aberdeen Proving Ground when 9/11 happened. And she was just instantly terrified. She right away understood that her whole life might be very different than what she had been envisioning. And it was not what she meant to sign up for.
And so what about the other two then? I mean, what were their situations on 9/11?
Well, it's fascinating because Debbie Helton, who would later become very close to Michelle, was driving to a meeting with the manager of the beauty salon where she worked when she heard the news over her car radio. And her immediate response was to wonder, would she get to do something useful in the Guard in response? And she identified really strongly with the firefighters and the policemen running up the stairs of the World Trade Center buildings. You know, she was listening to the news throughout the days that followed, hoping for news of survivors. She identified with all of the personnel who sort of, you know, emergency medical personnel and law enforcement who rushed in to try to help. And she really wanted to participate in that effort to help. She wanted to serve. She wanted to do something in response. And so she was actually, a couple of years passed before their unit got orders to deploy. And when the orders came, Michelle Fisher was ordered to go to Afghanistan as part of the armament team. And Debbie actually felt that Michelle had sort of taken her place. She thought she was going to be on the armament team. And she was upset that a younger woman was being sent and she was going to be left behind. And she actually argued her way onto the deployment because she was really, really wanting to go. And Michelle would have done anything to get out of that same deployment. So they had very different responses. For Desma, as a single mom with three children, you know, she had been married much of the time. She was in the Guard. Her marriage had fallen apart. She had gotten a divorce. By the time the deployment orders came, she was a single parent with three children. For her, it was devastating because of the separation from her children, even though she believed in the war. But she felt an even stronger compulsion to obey her orders and remain part of her unit. She couldn't envision her colleagues going without her, or you know, trying to wriggle out of a deployment when everybody else was having to leave their children and go. So she just felt obliged to obey the orders and go. She wasn't the only single parent in their battalion. I mean, one of her close friends would get orders to go on the Iraq deployment later, and she was also a single parent. So it was not a totally unique situation. And they just had to create what are called family plans and give legal custody of their children over to other individuals, make sure they had proof that their children would be well cared for while they were gone, which the military requires.
Were they able to find, was Desma able to find family members to take her kids on?
She did. She had a first cousin that she was very close to who also had young children who took her two daughters. Her son, who was a little bit older, went to stay with his father during that first deployment. During the second deployment, which happened 4 years later, when she was ordered to go to Iraq, her cousin felt she couldn't really handle taking the two girls again. So they went to live with paternal grandparents, and her son again went to stay with his father. By that point, her son had gotten kind of fed up with the upheavals that the deployments were creating in his life, and he told his mother, I'll go stay with my dad, but I'm not going to come back and live with you again. If I go stay with him now, I'm staying there through the end of high school. And it kind of broke Desma's heart when he said that, but she didn't feel she had a choice. She thought she had to go.
We have a call for you. Let's talk to Anne and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Helen Thorpe, the author of Soldier Girls.
I'm one of the minority of women in my generation with military experience. I graduated from high school in 1960, the second in my class of 140. No one in my family had ever been to college, even a community college. The 58 recession was still in full swing. I joined the Air Force in 1961. So my comment is, I think they should bring back the draft. And the reason I say that is because, just like these three women, the enlisted ranks are now full of lower middle class and poor, economically poor young people. And so it's a very classist situation, and these people become cannon fodder, and the people with higher income can completely ignore the wars that we get into and that sort of thing because their children aren't in any danger.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that. Your thoughts on that, Helen?
I really agree with the caller that there's a huge gulf between people who aren't serving in the military and those who have enlisted, and that essentially, as she's pointing out, people who don't have to enlist and who are economically better off essentially don't have any skin in the game, and so they do become emotionally more distant from the conflicts than everybody else who's being asked to serve. There's just a huge difference in terms of the emotional engagement.
Was this something you talked about with the women of Soldier Girls?
Absolutely, because when they returned home, they couldn't relate to the civilians around them, even members of their own family, who hadn't followed where they were or what was going on. They felt very angry at the disengagement around them.
Sounds almost like they went to another planet for a while. We'll talk more with Helen Thorpe about her book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War, back on the Jefferson Exchange with Helen, and your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 15. final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is a journalist, Helen Thorpe. Her articles have appeared in The New Yorker and Harper's Bazaar and Slate, among others. She's produced radio stories for This American Life and Soundprint. The author of two books. The latest is called Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. She follows three women from a National Guard unit based in Indiana through their overseas deployments and back to their private lives. We're talking overseas deployments in Afghanistan and Iraq. That is the subject matter of Soldier Girls. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about women in the military and deployments and promises made. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the difficulty of the women coming back, particularly from their second deployments, feeling like their families just weren't tracking where they were or anything. It seems like they just almost ceased to exist for their families during that time they were gone.
I know that there are many more technologies that allow people who are serving overseas to stay in touch, like email, Skype, things like this, and they did use some of those tools. But so when Michelle came back from Afghanistan, at a certain point she was hanging out with her sister, and a friend of her sister's said something about her being overseas, and her sister asked her, now, where were you in Iraq? And Michelle said, I was in Afghanistan. And, you know, the fact that close family members couldn't track which country she was in, which war she had been participating in, was, you know, it made her blood boil, because she had been sent over there for a full year. She had made all these sacrifices. She had, you know, lived in a tent. There were camel spiders. The whole experience had been intense and overwhelming, and the fact that they couldn't even pay attention to which country she had been to, she found terribly frustrating. And yet, from the point of view of the relatives at home, the two wars were kind of jumbled in their minds, and they couldn't easily keep track of the names of these very foreign-sounding cities. They couldn't follow the war narratives, which they just weren't clear what was happening over there. So all of them returned home to family members who were having a hard time understanding what they had just lived through.
Flip that around, though, to the women who actually were serving over there. I mean, how clear were they on the objectives of their mission and the politics that led up to them and all that sort of thing? Were there different degrees? I mean, you pointed out that Debbie, I guess, didn't even vote and generally was good at following orders. Michelle and Desma, a little more politically active than that. So were there differences in their own observations of what was going on around them when they were in country?
Yeah, absolutely. So to give Debbie's point of view a little bit more three dimensions, Debbie is the kind of person who finds in the military what a lot of people find at church, a community. And it's very important to her to belong and to be a good team player. So she's not only good at following orders, but she's good at morale. And she's good at keeping up the morale of other people. And that's why Michelle, with very different political beliefs, would turn to her during the deployment as a source of comfort and strength. But Debbie does shy away from politics, and she thinks of it as a place where she's not as skilled or as competent. Michelle's very political and very engaged in political arguments. But she also subscribes to sort of very specific ideologies. She would describe herself as a leftist. She therefore viewed the wars through, like, the way she would consume news about the wars was on Democracy Now! And Adbusters.
Wow.
So she had a very sort of radical, you know, left-leaning perspective on things, which made it really hard for her to then serve in the military at the same time. Desma, who had voted for Bush in 2000 and supported the steps that he took after 9/11 that led to the war in Afghanistan, Desma's a big consumer of news, and she likes getting news from different sources. She watches television news on things like MSNBC. She listens to BBC Radio. I mean, Desna is a very fascinating person. She had dropped out of high school at 15. She was pregnant at 16. She had her son at 17. And then she went on to get her GED, and she scored so high that she was in the top 10% of people who took the GED that year in Indiana.
Wow.
She's really smart, but she's had a bumpy life. Sometimes she's made choices that have contributed to that. Sometimes she's had bad luck. But she's very smart, and she's very astute in terms of how she consumes news and the way she thinks about it. And so Desna had a very nuanced sense of the two conflicts, and while she thought Afghanistan made a lot of sense, she was extremely skeptical about the decision to go into Iraq and really worried about whether there were going to be enough troops to support both wars and have a successful outcome.
We'd already talked about the differences in approaches to training, for example, that Michelle, generally because of her view of the world and politics and things like that, had a little tougher time. Debbie's the kind of person who would keep her head down and just do what she needed to do to make it easier, you said. Desma, you know, given her intelligence and also her unwillingness to take a lot of guff off of people, I mean, what were her relations with superiors often like in the military?
I think Desma's always had issues with people in authority. You know, she dropped out of high school after getting in an argument with the principal over whether she was being adequately supported after missing school due to tonsillitis and a surgery and all that. She thought the teachers weren't helping her catch up, and he sort of didn't listen sympathetically. She got in a huge argument with him, threw her books at him, and stormed out and never went back to high school.
Yowza.
So she has these moments where she you know, will get very angry and especially towards somebody in authority. She had some problematic interactions with people in authority in the military too, but at the same time, she did really well in the structured environment. She herself would say that she lacked discipline and she wasn't going to go anywhere in life until she enlisted in the military, which provided her with a lot of discipline, and she then thrived in that environment. So during her second deployment in Iraq, something very interesting happened to Desma, which was her support battalion, they all got orders to go to Iraq, but they were not going to go as a coherent entity as they had when they went to Afghanistan. Instead, their battalion was being broken up, and they were being spread across everywhere else in their brigade to different units that needed personnel. Desma wound up being transferred into a previously all-male infantry regiment, where the men were very hostile to the idea that women were suddenly being foisted upon them. There were a handful of other women in the company that she was serving in. Desma recalls there being two other women. Company of 100 individuals.
Wow.
So in that environment, she got a lot of hostility from the guys, and I think she dished out a lot of hostility back in return. It was very full of friction, her relations with others.
Now, but I'm glad you brought up the male-female relations, because those seem to be two extremes, and the other one is that Michelle in particular, as attractive as she was in basic training, apparently got hit on by a fair number of male soldiers and took some of them up on it, too.
So Michelle was 21 when she wound up deploying to Afghanistan. She was very young and also very attractive, and the younger female soldiers did get an inordinate amount of attention from the men they were serving with. Debbie, 30 years older than Michelle, looked on at this and is often commenting on it in the diaries that she was keeping at the time. And she's impressed with how Michelle is handling this sort of extreme attention. And she's a little bit wistful, and she writes occasionally that it's been a long time since men paid her that kind of attention. For Michelle, it does rise to a level where it's oppressive, because just the propositions, the catcalls, the hoots, the offers of all kinds of interaction continue from dawn to dusk, day after day. In that kind of environment, she ended up seeking a relationship with a man who was married and in a problematic marriage at home with a woman that he described to Michelle as being a drug addict. So they had an affair during their time in Afghanistan, and for Michelle, she would say she doesn't approve of the choice that she made. She feels actually quite guilty about it. But it offered her essentially protection, that relationship, because while she was in that man's company, the rest of the guys would leave her alone.
So it was a protective kind of situation. I mean, it was a, you know, she just, it was a defensive move, basically.
Right.
Wow. And so how much soul searching did these women do? And did it tend to happen while they were on deployment? I mean, do you have time to think about that when you're worried about potentially getting shot the next day? Or did the soul searching go on when they got back home and tried to readjust to life and try to figure out, oh my God, who am I?
They did a lot of soul searching, and it's still going on. I actually think the exercise of participating in this book project was one of soul searching for them and trying to come to terms with everything. I don't think the soul searching tended to happen as much during the deployments as it did when they got back home, and that's part of what was hard about coming back home. So say, for example, Michelle, having had a relationship with a man who was married, for him it was an extramarital affair, when she got home, she was clinging to him. They have to fill out a health assessment as part of the return home. The military requires it. And in that form, it asks questions like, are you in a relationship? Do you envision this continuing? And she's writing, yes, I'm in a serious relationship. I absolutely envision this continuing. And she's thinking of that soldier that she was with during the deployment to Afghanistan. But he's coming home, returning to his wife and children. And they immediately fall into a situation where it's hard to see each other. He's now having to confront the fact that he's actually cheating on his wife. And she's having to confront that fact much more obviously than when they were both far away in Afghanistan together. And the relationship falls apart as he starts selling drugs and the reality of his situation at home starts to come home. She becomes frightened of him as he grows threatening to her as he feels her pulling away, and she ends the relationship. But she did tons of soul searching about what did it mean that she had chosen to be with him, what kind of person was he, what kind of person was she that she made that choice. She was really wrangling with all of that.
Given how much they revealed to you, I mean, were there moments, Helen, when you just said, you know what, don't tell me that part. I can't include that. I mean, you're telling me too much now. Was there ever a TMI moment?
I did feel surprised at the level at which they were willing to share. And I think part of the reason they shared so much and so openly had to do with their military service and the fact that when they were overseas, they were leading a communal life in which there were very few, if any, secrets. One of the things they described over and over again was how living on a military base, everybody knows everything about you. You just can't keep anything secret. And I think, therefore, they shared very openly with me because they were still in that mode of imagining that these stories were essentially public. And because I was interviewing them sometimes together with each other, they would have a tendency to just sort of include me in their circle and speak as openly as they might if I wasn't even in the room.
When they look back at what they've been through now, I mean, things have changed so much since the Vietnam War when, you know, soldiers got things thrown at them. They wouldn't get off planes in the uniforms for fear that they'd get yelled at and spit on, as many people did. But, you know, now everybody in uniform is labeled a hero. How do these women feel about being called heroes, and did they feel they were brave?
It's a great question. I think they struggle with it a little bit. To be honest, it's not that they don't appreciate the intention, but they feel themselves to be very human, and they know their own struggles and the coping mechanisms that they developed, some of which they're not proud of. And so they struggle with the idea of being called a hero. The way Michelle articulates this is she craves understanding. She wants to be heard, and she doesn't want a meaningless thanks for your service. She wants people to know what she lived through.
which explains a lot about why she revealed so much in the book, as did the other two women, Debbie and Desma. The book is called Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. Helen Thorpe wrote it, and she's been our guest today. Helen, thank you so much for taking the time.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
All right, take care.